I don't know. I wasn't really listening.
The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Transparency, Spinrilla and PRS. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. He's Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very tired.
Not good enough.
I've had a very busy week.
No.
And as a result of that...
This is boring chat already.
I'm very tired. So there you go. I went to Cardiff yesterday.
Yeah.
That's in Wales.
I've heard of it.
I never know how good your geography is. When you're born and bred in southern England, you sort of have a very vague concept of the rest of the United Kingdom.
I've travelled.
So it's true, you've been to Kendal. Is it Kendal where there's the pencil museum?
Yeah.
That you're such a big fan of?
It's a good museum.
And that's definitely up north.
Yeah.
Can't deny that. But it's not in Wales, whereas Cardiff is in Wales. And so it was the first of the CMU DIY Barod sessions. So Barod is a new scheme set up by the people behind the Soon Festival, which is the showcase festival that takes place in Cardiff each year. And they've set up this new education programme for young artists. And as part of that, we are basically the CMU Insights Seminars programme that we do in London at various points during the year, which is really aimed at people who work in the business. So people who work at labels or publishers or promoters or whatever. And we're sort of repurposing it aimed at artists. And so it's the first time we've done it. And it was the first one of those last night. So yes, that was quite a busy day. I had to speed over to Cardiff, do some stuff, and then speed back to London. And on my way back on the train, can you picture that?
Yes.
On a train speeding from Cardiff to London.
Do they go that quickly on that line?
It was 2 hours. I don't know whether that's...
that's right.
I don't really have much concept of quite how far London to Cardiff is, so I don't know whether 2 hours is good or whether it's a bit rubbish. But anyway, I had to do some editing on my way back because I have another podcast.
Oh, right.
Did you know I had another podcast?
No.
I moonlight. I have another podcast called TW Talks, which is the podcast of our other website, This Week London, and also 3 weeks Edinburgh, so our culture websites. And so we have this podcast, and it doesn't happen all the time. Not like this podcast that
happens all the time.
Just keep constantly dropping onto your phone. It's like, oh God, I've got to listen to another edition of the CMU podcast. No, the TW Talks podcast comes out in little series. This is the second series.
Yeah.
So the first series was recorded at last year's Edinburgh Festival, and we interviewed 5 comedians, all of whom are big names at the Edinburgh Festival and have all appeared on the cover of our 3 weeks Edinburgh Festival magazine at some point in the last 20 years. And so that's what we did last August. And now we're back in London, and it's the Vault Festival. Have you heard of the Vault Festival, Andy
Malt? Aware of the Vault Festival.
Are you culturally aware?
Yes.
So the Vault Festival is a sort of fringy type festival that takes place in London, in some vaults, every February in the depth of winter. And it's a bit like a mini Edinburgh because they have lots of people who we would normally associate performing up at the Edinburgh Festival coming and doing their shows. And like the Fringe, they'll often do, you know, more than one performance. I mean, some people just do one or two shows, but some people do like a full week or maybe even more of that of their show, which I suppose if you're at the sort of the fringy end of theatre, comedy, cabaret, you don't often get the opportunity necessarily to do multiple night runs. And so really great programme happening at the Vault Festival. It kicked off at the start of the month, and we are interviewing a bunch of people who are performing over the next few weeks. So if you go to thisweektalks.com, you can listen to it through Audio Boom there, download it, sign up, all that usual podcast stuff. And the first of those went out yesterday as you're listening to this podcast, and I had to finish the editing on the train on the way back.
Well, that's a good use of your train journey.
So that's a guy who had a show up at the festival last year that our reviewer loved. It's a one-man show. He plays a number of different characters. I think it sort of starts off quite straight and then all goes a bit bizarre and absurd towards the end. So our reviewer loved it, although since he performed it in Edinburgh last August and performing it now at the Vault Festival, he's decided that he wants to do it naked.
Of course.
So in the Vault Festival version, even though that's in a vault in February, I'm not sure it's the right time of year to be introducing the naked version of your show. But he's decided that that's what he's going to do. And in the interview, he explains his thought processes around that element to the show.
And his name is...
His name is Adam Scott Rowley. And yeah, if you listen to the podcast, I can't remember. The show's on, I think it kicks off on the 15th of February. So if you go to thisweektalks.com, you can listen to the podcast and all the listings and stuff will be there. So yeah, I have another podcast.
Well, we've all got another podcast.
What's your other podcast?
I don't.
You don't have another podcast. Try harder.
I could.
You
could if I wanted.
Well, I look forward to
But I'm loyal to this one.
Well, the next couple of weeks on the CMU podcast are not going to be straight podcasts.
No.
It's going to be highlights from one of our CMU Insights conference sessions. So that's the next 2 weeks. So we're not going to be doing a proper sitting down chatting about the news podcast for a couple of weeks. So you've
got... That's nothing
got...
to do with my loyalty to the podcast.
No, I'm not. I wasn't saying that was anything to do with your loyalty to the podcast.
Well, the implication was there.
What I was saying is that's an opportunity for you to launch your second spin-off Moonlighting podcast.
Right, maybe I'll do that then.
So, you know, you've got the kit, you've got a duvet. We all know that you can record podcasts at home because you did one edition of the CMU podcast from home.
Yes.
So get out the old digital recorder and the duvet and Andy Malt under the duvet. There you go. I've even come up with a name for your other podcast.
It doesn't sound like a very good podcast.
From under the duvet or some play on that concept. So... I look forward to listening to that.
Yeah, well, let's get on with this one.
Okay,
first.
Tell us what's happening on this podcast.
On this podcast, we're going to look at why mixtape website Spinrilla is in the music industry's bad books. And we'll answer another of your questions, listeners. This one on PRS and PPL licenses, when you might not need one.
Or when you might think you don't need one, but
you probably do.
You do. It all began with the question, does PRS need a PRS license? So, hey, stay tuned and we'll answer whether or not PRS needs a PRS license.
Yes, but first, let's have a little look at some transparency, if that is not an oxymoron. So on Monday this week, the guys down at the House of Lords had a little chat.
They did.
About transparency in music.
So this was the Digital Economy Bill, which we've talked about before on the podcast. So it's the miscellaneous piece of legislation that will update all sorts of law, anything to do with digital and the internet, because
it's all, you know, just bunch it all in.
Because that's still appropriate in 2017. If it's to do with the internet, just let's lump it all together. So it was a real mishmash piece of legislation. But in there is there's the second ticketing stuff that we talked about earlier, the bot ban, which we talked about last year. But also, any digital stuff around copyright is up for debate when a digital economy bill is going through Parliament. And so it has now passed the Lords. It went through the Commons last year. And we mentioned this in last week's podcast, I think, Tim Clement-Jones, who's a Liberal Democrat Lord in the House of Lords, he had put forward an amendment to the digital economy bill, which has certain parallels with part of the European Copyright Directive. So we talked last year about how copyright law is up for review at a European level. So a draft European Copyright Directive was published last year. And in there was an article which was basically trying to provide a certain degree of transparency, particularly for artists and songwriters, not just in the music industry, so the same would apply, particularly in the book industry, where authors are assigning their rights to publishers, but basically to give creators and performers who are involved in the creation of something that is protected by copyright, whether that's a song or a recording or whatever else, but then they don't actually own those rights, because the rights get assigned to a record company or a music publisher, or even if it's not complete full assignment, it's as good as. They sort of lose day-to-day control of those rights. And then a record company or a publisher or maybe a collecting society then goes off and does deals with a Spotify or an Apple Music or an iTunes or whatever. And then on the back of those deals, money then starts coming in to the label, to the distributor, to the publisher, to the collecting society. And then under contract, all of those people are obliged to share that money with the artists and the songwriters who actually created the content at the outset. And as we have discussed forever on the podcast, a lot of artists and a lot of songwriters and a lot of managers and lawyers and accountants who work for artists and songwriters have been saying that since we've seen the shift from physical product in music over to digital, and particularly since we've seen the shift from downloads over to streams, the deals that are being done between the labels, the publishers, the collecting societies and the Spotifys of this world are shrouded in secrecy. Artists aren't allowed to know what's in the deal. Songwriters aren't allowed to know what's in the deal. The managers and lawyers and accountants of those people are not allowed to know what's in the deal. And therefore, there's a complete lack of transparency of exactly how the streaming business works, what Spotify is paying, on what basis they're paying that, and often what happens to the money as it moves through the music company to the songwriter, the artist, or whoever. And this came up in the Dissecting the Digital Dollar Report.
It did.
We talked about that when Annabella came in, when we launched part two of the Digital Dollar Report, the Music Managers Forum report last year. And following all of those roundtables we did with artists and songwriters and lots of managers, transparency was the issue that kept coming up. The fact that there is so much secrecy around these deals. Some music companies give more information than others. Some of the indies in particular are trying to explain and share the important information about the digital deals that they have done. But there are still lots of gaps. So artists and songwriters and managers can understand how a Spotify-type deal is structured by reading Dissecting the Digital Dollar Part 1. So we know how the deal is structured. What we don't know is the specifics. We don't know the revenue share arrangement. We don't know the minimum guarantees that have been agreed. We don't know whether there's any equity or fees as part of the deal. And artists and songwriters and managers would say they need to know that information for two reasons. First of all, they need to know whether or not the label or the publisher or the Cat Society is paying them what they're due. And yeah. The music industry is an industry where there is 60 years of distrust between labels and publishers and artists and songwriters when it comes to the processing of royalties. And whenever there's any secrecy about how royalties have been calculated, artists and songwriters generally assume that means they're being screwed over. The other thing is, obviously, we're in an era where the entire music community needs to persuade consumers to start signing up to paid-for streaming services, because that is what is driving the growth in the recorded music market. But, you know, the more savvy artists and managers are saying, how are we to know which services we should be putting our time behind? Which services should we be telling fans to sign up to when we don't know? How much better is Spotify to Apple to Tidal as far as artists are concerned? Because we can't see the deals. And so the artist community, songwriter community, the management community are trying to put pressure on labels and publishers and collecting societies to be more transparent, to share this information. And a bit of progress has been made. Certainly on the indie side, the Worldwide Independent Network have their Fair Deals Declaration, which makes a few commitments on transparency. But the general perception is there's still a lot of work to be done here across the board. The article that was contained within last year's European Copyright Directive, I mean, as it's currently worded, I would argue there are too many get-outs for labels and publishers to say, yeah, we don't have to do this because, look, this item number 3, item number 4 provides us with the get-outs. But people are lobbying. They're trying to get that article tightened up as the directive goes through the motions. But what Tim Clement-Jones was trying to do was basically saying, well, this commitment's going to be in the European Copyright Directive, which may or may not be relevant here, depending on how quickly the directive gets passed and how quickly we exit the European Union.
Yeah.
So it may or may not automatically become law here, but he was saying, surely this is something that we should be supporting. And while the industry may be making moves in the right direction, they are doing so very slowly as far as artists and managers are concerned. And so there should be some pressure on corporate rights owners to share more information with artists and songwriters. And perhaps copyright law should be rewritten to put an obligation onto those corporate rights owners so that artists and songwriters have a right to know what's going on. And so that was the amendment that Tim Clement-Jones put forward. It was debated in the Lords earlier this week, and both he and another member of the House of Lords spoke in favour of the amendment.
Yeah, Tim Clement-Jones gave a reasonably long speech in favour of his amendment. He said that the evolution of this licensing process for streaming music has resulted in a number of transparency issues for artists and songwriters, which have not yet been fully addressed. And then in terms of his amendment, he was saying authors and performers under these provisions will have a right to detailed and full statements on the uses of and revenues from their work, unless such reporting is disproportionate. That's his amendment in a nutshell. But we don't need to know that, because his amendment has been withdrawn because the government is in favour of it.
Yes, one of those slightly complicated scenarios. I mean, Tim Clement-Jones didn't necessarily expect his amendment to actually go through. For him, it was really putting it on the agenda.
I think that's possibly what he'd said in a quote he gave us before, that, you know, this is a first attempt at getting this on the statute book.
That was about another amendment that he put
was
forward.
It?
But I'm sure he would say,
probably say the same thing about this.
The same thing. That this is a debate that is ongoing in Brussels, but he wanted the debate to be on the agenda in Westminster, and so that happened. And basically the government came along and said, oh, well, do you know this is in the European directive? He'd already said that he knew it was in the European directive. They were saying, this debate's happening at Europe. Hey, we love the European Union at the moment. That isn't actually what they said. But we're carrying on doing the Europe stuff, is basically what they said. And so this debate's already happening in Brussels, and British artists and British copyright owners are involved in that debate. And so we're confident it can be addressed there. And so that's where this debate should continue. There's no need at this point to insert something bespoke in the Digital Economy Bill while those conversations are ongoing, was the government's position. And on the back of that, Tim Clement-Jones agreed to withdraw his amendment, although he did sort of say it was nice to hear the government agree that we need this transparency, although he wished they would be a little bit more specific about their commitment to get that transparency right for artists actually into the law.
Yeah, so the representative of the government who was in the debate, Peter Buscombe, said that the principle of transparency is an important element of well-functioning markets, and said, you know, she was aware that some people find it difficult to get the right information. So, you know, all in favour, and then went on to say, this is all being debated in the EU and we're still part of that, so we're part of that debate, so it's all fine. And while he welcomed Buscombe's agreement with the principle of transparency and it being key to a working digital marketplace, he also noted, I am not sure she went so far as to support its incorporation into law.
Of course, if the article in the EU directive gets through and it gets amended slightly to be more watertight, and if all that happens pre-Brexit, then by default it will become part of UK law. And obviously what the UK government has said is at the point of Brexit, any laws that have come from Europe will remain. And then subsequently,
yay, remain.
And then may subsequently get amended once we're outside the EU. It does currently feel like the directive will get passed pre-Brexit, although who knows? Because both timelines are a little bit unclear at the moment. And if that doesn't happen, then the artist community over here will need to lobby to push to get it bespoke into UK law. So we'll see. But good to see such an important issue for the artist and management community being discussed in Parliament this week.
Still to come, we'll find out if you really should be getting yourself some PRS and PPL licences. But now, let's talk about someone else without licences, Spinrilla.
Yeah, the latest bit of piracy litigation in the music industry. New chapter in the long-running battle between the music industry and online piracy. So this is a lawsuit filed by the American record industry, so the American majors via the Recording Industry Association of America, going after this site called Spinrilla, which is a mixtape sharing platform.
Yeah, so it gives you access to lots and lots of unofficial hip-hop mixtapes because there are lots and lots of those. So basically, I think users can upload them and then they can either download them or they can stream them.
You have to be an invited user to do an upload. So anybody can download and stream, but you have to apply and then be invited to be an uploader. So the idea is, this is bedroom DJs, aspiring hip-hop artists who are creating these unofficial mixtapes, and they pump them into the Spinrilla system and then users can access them there. So they're sort of like a platform for mixtapes. This isn't a straight file-sharing case or illegal streaming service case because it hones in on the classic hip-hop mixtape. And it's always interested me that for years and years and years now, all aspiring hip-hop artists, right at the start of their career, one of the first things they do is they put together unofficial mixtapes. They sort of sample and mix other people's music, you know, big artists' music, and then they put them out. And if you go back far enough away, they were actually taping them onto cassette and distributing them. And then, of course, it all went online and they were distributing with the file sharing networks. I suspect these days, actually, the mixtapes are more likely to get uploaded. SoundCloud was very big for that for a time, and then their sort of equivalent of Content ID got too good and they kept getting pulled down, although that may not be happening quite so much now that SoundCloud is licensed. But Mixcloud is very good for this because Mixcloud in some countries is licensed through the Creative Licensing System. So a really good place to put up these mixtapes. But even when people were handing them out on cassette, straight copyright infringement, no questions there. In the main, the record industry has always turned a blind eye to the mixtape and not pursued legal action against these aspiring artists.
And that's, I guess, well, because you've got to recognise that most of your big hip-hop artists started out putting out mixtapes. I mean, it's such part of the culture that actually lots of big artists still do it.
They do.
You know, it's a part of the culture and it's sort of a recognised thing. And yeah, so the labels sort of turn a bit of a blind eye.
Well, it'd be
it.
Hypocritical of any of the big hip-hop artists of today to allow their labels to go after some aspiring rapper for infringing their music, because you could immediately go back and find their mixtapes. Well, as you say, some of them continue to put it out. If they're between albums, they've got nothing else to do, they'll put out a mixtape. But certainly you'll be able to go back in the early stages of their career and find all the tracks that they were ripping off at the time. So it would be hugely hypocritical.
But the difference here is that what it's a recognised part of the culture, individuals making tapes, sharing them amongst whoever. I mean, obviously a wider audience once you get out onto the internet. But Spinrilla is building a business off the back of that.
Yes, and I suppose that's the issue.
That's what's pissed them off.
They are going after the company behind, and indeed the guy behind this platform and the resulting app. And I think there are probably various reasons why Spinrilla has come to the top of the record industry's litigation list. First of all, there is a premium version of the app. So they make a little bit of money through ad sales, but you can pay. It's not much. It's a relatively cheap subscription. But I think the difference between freemium and premium is the premium allows you to download as well as stream. So offline listening. So the fact that there's actually, not only is he getting a bit of ad income, there's actually a subscription business being built around this. Also, if you Google Spinrilla, one thing you'll notice is a number of articles published in the last year or so, those sort of top five sources of digital music articles that you get on tech sites or whatever from time to time. And frequently Spinrilla, because it has a really good collection of mixtapes, is appearing in amongst Spotify and Google Play and Tidal. So being frequently listed with totally licensed.
So looks like a legit service.
Looks like it's sitting with all of those. So I imagine these are some of the reasons why this litigation has sort of reached the top of the list as far as the record industry is concerned. I assume that once Spinrilla's lawyers have got through the legal filing, their response will probably be safe harbours.
Yes.
That old chestnut.
There is a whole page on the Spinrilla site dedicated to how to submit your DMCA takedown notices.
Yeah, there's a template email that you can cut and paste.
So, yeah, I would guess that safe harbours is going to be the defence, because why else would you have that page?
So they're going to say that it's a user-generated platform and we're just like YouTube, we're just like SoundCloud. And because we have this system for taking content down, if the rights owners don't want it there, the system being send us an email. It's not like a content ID platform. It is send an email. But they have that takedown system in place. American copyright law doesn't set the bar very high for takedown systems. So they will almost certainly come with a safe harbour defence. And then that will be yet another test for that very unpopular element of copyright law. Unpopular amongst the music industry, very popular amongst tech startups. So we'll see. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose one thing the record industry will say is it used to be 20 years ago that there was no way a aspiring rapper or aspiring producer, MC, whatever, could put out a mixtape in a legal way because it would be nigh on impossible for them to go and get licenses for that with next to no money. Whereas we're now in an age where you can put it on Mixcloud, you can put it on SoundCloud. And of course, there's that company who are trying to sort out a way of licensing mixes so they can even go into Spotify and Apple Music. And so for the first time, the music industry is slowly providing ways where anybody who does a mix can legally distribute it online, so therefore there's no excuse to be having an unlicensed platform in 2017. So it will be interesting to see which of the classic piracy litigation arguments get aired when these guys respond.
Yeah, I mean, the RIA, not mincing its words, said in its statement when it announced this lawsuit that Spinrilla specialises in ripping off music creators. Strong opening gambit there.
But it's a good speciality. But I think the founder guy's got it on his CV. top skills, according to the RIAA.
Ripping off music creators.
He can put that at the bottom of his LinkedIn profile. So, they are yet to formally respond to this lawsuit. So we'll wait to see whether or not they will seek deals, whether they'll fight or roll over and shut the damn thing down.
Just quickly, time to look through a few other music business stories from this week before we get to our listener question. News that's just come in as we were about to record. Breaking news. It won't be breaking news by the time you hear the podcast.
News.
But breaking
news
at the moment.
Out. Time now for some old news, everybody.
Is that Universal Music has finally done its deal to represent the bulk of Prince. Well, not the bulk. Well, yeah, no, the bulk of Prince's recording catalogue. Many of his latter albums at the moment.
So as you're aware, since Prince died, his estate and the two guys who are, for the time being, running his estate, not necessarily with the approval of all of Prince's siblings.
As previously discussed.
But they've been busy doing deals around the various parts of the Prince business. And so the first deal they did was around his publishing assets. And so they decided to go with Universal for that. Then it was merch and branding. And they decided to go with Universal for that. And now they've done a deal around recordings. And they've decided, why didn't they just... one deal. I mean, Universal Music, Universal Music Publishing, and Bravado, Universal's merch company, I suppose they do operate autonomously from each other.
Maybe they just are, you know, it's coincidence that they're all got the same parent company, but maybe they genuinely are the best, all of them.
Perhaps the two guys running the estate don't like crossing roads, and so therefore they were in the Universal building, they were doing the deals, and they were going to go across the road to the Sony building, but oh, I don't like crossing roads, and perhaps that's the real reason why the heirs are trying to have them kicked off managing the estate.
Because they don't like crossing roads.
Because they don't like crossing roads. And so it just happened that Universal were on one side of the road and everybody else was on the other side of the road in this imaginary street in my head, in whichever. I assume they were negotiating these deals in LA, but I don't even know why I'm assuming that. But anyway, yeah. So yeah. Prince is now fully in bed with Universal.
Yes. Well, not quite fully, but this deal does represent all the MPG Records releases, which is 25 albums. It's all his latter day albums,
yeah, so not
mid-90s onwards, and possibly most importantly his vault of unreleased recordings,
yes,
which is what's going to see them through for
the next 4,000
years, yeah, or 4,000 if you like.
I do like,
and they're also going to get the US rights to the albums released between 1979 and 1995 at the beginning of next year.
So busy on the Universal front there. Last time Universal represented some of Prince's assets, it resulted in the slightly comedic, long-drawn-out Dancing Baby lawsuit. So let's see what litigation the Universal Music Group can get Prince into.
And there almost
this
certainly
time
will
round.
Be some.
So I look forward to that.
Speaking of US rights, which we almost were then.
Speaking of litigation, which we definitely were then.
Duran Duran have been given the all clear to appeal their lawsuit against Sony ATV.
So we've talked about this on the podcast.
We have.
This is Duran Duran's attempts to get back the American rights in their early songs, which they assigned to a publisher in the early 1980s here in the UK. That publisher is now a subsidiary of Sony ATV. Sony ATV are saying, you're not an American, so you don't get your American rights back under American copyright law. And Duran Duran are saying, that's not our understanding. So this all went to court last year. Sony ATV won on round number one. So now they are appealing. So this, A, confirms that Duran Duran are formally going through with an appeal, which we suspected, although we hadn't had confirmation of that. And B, the judge has allowed it to go to appeal. So this will go back to court, I assume, at some point later this year. Paul McCartney, for one, is watching this case with interest because he is trying to get his American rights back in the Lennon and McCartney catalogue from Sony ATV as we speak. And although Sony ATV haven't told him he can't have them back, he suspects that they're basically procrastinating to see the outcome of this case and they may then interfere down the line. So reversion rights will be very much in the news again later this year.
Spotify, we expected, would IPO this year sometime. Probably not going to happen now.
Probably not going to happen,
not
according to
TechCrunch.
TechCrunch, and they wouldn't lie.
No.
Why would they lie?
What would be in it for them?
So, yeah, Spotify's got to float at some point. And we've mentioned this before on the podcast. Last year, it may be the year before, we really ought to check. Did you check that when reporting this story? When did they borrow this billion from some
last year
money-lending people? They borrowed this $1 billion, and a condition of that is that the longer they put off their IPO, the more expensive that loan becomes. A, because the money lenders can turn the debt into equity at a discount at the point of IPO.
And that discount gets higher.
And higher.
For every 6 months after the first year.
Plus, I think, do the interest costs go up as well?
Yeah, the interest is already 5% to start with, and 5% of $1 billion is $50 million. So it's not a small interest bill already. That will be coming up in March, I think, that payment. And then I think if they don't IPO before March 2018, then like they've got another $65 million in interest to come.
So it is in Spotify's interest to get their flotation, get on the stock exchange, we assume in New York ASAP. However, the reason TechCrunch was giving, citing various sources, why they're now looking at 2018 rather than 2017 is, well, these ongoing deals with the labels that we've been talking about for some time, well, they're clearly not done the deals yet, and they cannot go to Wall Street without at least a 2-year deal in place with Sony, Universal and Warner. They also, were they talking about getting their user figures up or their something
well,
or other?
They doing a different pricing.
Oh, they did. That was interesting, wasn't it? By getting a mid-range pricing with a, you would only be allowed to listen to any one track a certain number of times any one month, which sounds remarkably like that thing Spotify tried a few years ago.
And then decided it was,
decided
not
was a terrible
work.
Idea. So I don't quite know why that's seemingly back on the agenda, assuming TechCrunch's sources are correct. Also, of course, Snapchat is now on the road to flotation. And I suppose, I mean, obviously Snapchat, Spotify, on one level, they're in very different markets, but they are tech startups. So I think everybody will be looking at the Snapchat IPO as a gauge as to just how much stupid money mad Wall Street people will throw at vastly overvalued digital things. Although at least Spotify has a revenue stream, so it has one up on Snapchat.
I'll tell you who was popular on Spotify last year.
Who was popular on Spotify last year?
Drake! And I know this not only because Spotify put out about 700 press releases about it, but Drake was popular everywhere last year. The world over, in all possible medium.
The International Federation of the Phonographic Industry has declared him the most successful artist of 2016.
Yeah, so they've given him their Global Recording Artist of the Year award.
So that means lots of sales, lots of downloads, lots of streams. More people were listening to Drake records last year than any other artist in the world.
I'm not sure that Drake being popular is news or worthy of an award, but the top 10 list of artists who were the most popular of the year was quite interesting.
Well, personally, I sort of think this might be grounds for us in our new Theresa May mates with Donald Trump, we hate the world policy that we're pursuing here in the United Kingdom. I think this could be grounds for war with Canada. Because, of course, Drake is Canadian. Yeah. And if it hadn't been for Drake, tell us who the top three would have been had Drake not interfered.
Well, David Bowie would have been at number one.
And that would have been nice.
It would have been nice because he's dead. Coldplay would have been at number two.
Which would have been less nice, but you know.
But now they're at number three.
For patriotic reasons, it would have been good.
Adele after Coldplay.
So, had Drake not bothered the music fans of the world with his music, all of the three biggest selling artists, or biggest selling, most successful, whatever we're calling it these days, of 2016 would have been British.
Yeah.
Bloody Drake. I mean, Bowie even went to the effort of dying to secure his place. All Drake did was put out a record and then balance on top of the CN Tower. I mean, that's basically what he did last year, wasn't it?
Yes.
And I don't think that's enough. Having said that, a flip side, if we're trying to try to be, you know, building bridges. Let's assume that the Theresa May Donald Trump relationship, they're going to fall out in a few months' time. Perhaps we could form an alliance with Canada, because if Canada and the UK became one country, then we would have had the whole top five.
That's true. But as it stands, the top five is a Canadian sandwich with a triple decker British filling.
It's an Anglo-Canadian top five.
Because Justin Bieber's number five.
Bieber is at five.
And he's a Canadian no matter what you say.
So, so Drake, Bowie, Coldplay, Adele, Bieber. It's, frankly, providing the UK and Canada continue to pump out pop stars, everyone else can basically stop.
And
including,
therefore, well, yes, what is interesting about this list is you have to go to number six before you get an American artist.
Ha!
And that is 21 Pilots.
Has anyone told Donald Trump? He'll just blame Obama, won't he? He'll be telling you that in 2017, all of the top 10 will be America artists.
But as it stands, let's run through the top 10. Number one, Drake, Bowie, Coldplay, Adele, Bieber, 21 Pilots, Beyonce, Rihanna, Prince, The Weeknd. There's only three US-born artists in that list.
Indeed. Rihanna's Barbados. Who else isn't?
The Weeknd's Canadian.
Of course he is. Yeah, so another one for Canada. Yeah. So overall, UK, Canada were equal there. We've each got three. Barbados has one, and then America has three. Oh, so we're all at, across the 10, we're on level playing field. UK, US, Canada. But Canada gets number one, and we get the next three. So we're both better than the United States of America.
Yeah.
Is the message here. So there you go. America sixth, as it turns out. They'll all have to change their hashtags, all the Trump supporters. No longer America first. Hey, do you want another list?
Yeah, sure. I love lists.
Talking of lists and America, this has just been published as we're recording the podcast. So you know how Billboard do their list, their most important people in music list?
The Power 100.
That's what it's called, the Power 100. Well, the Power 100 2017 is out, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
So, who do you reckon? I mean, normally obviously the two biggest music companies in the world. Universal is the biggest on the sort of the music rights, recordings, publishing side. Live Nation is the biggest on the live ticketing management side.
Yes.
So usually, most powerful people in music, it's the bosses of those two companies. The two people who happen to work their way up the hierarchy then get the power top. So that's either Lucian or it is Michael.
Yeah.
Universal, Live Nation. Who do you think is going to be number one this year?
Well,
who's more important, Universal or Live Nation?
The fact that you just built it up so much suggests it's neither of them.
It is neither of them. You're correct. You spotted the ruse. The aforementioned Spotify, Daniel Ek, is number one.
Oh, so the US isn't even biggest in music
hasn't even
on anything.
It hasn't even topped the list of its own trade magazine for the most powerful people in music. So, although he spends a lot of his time in New York now, doesn't he? So
Daniel Ek.
I think he's probably been adopted. So, yeah, so interestingly, I'll just quickly read you through the chart. It's interesting. So you've got Daniel at number one, then Lucian, then Michael at Live Nation, Eddie at Apple, Rob at Columbia, Irving Azoff, obviously, with his...
the first one to get a surname.
With the various little business ventures that he has, his management business, but also his performing rights organisation, etc. Marty Bandier over at Sony ATV Publishing, Stephen Cooper at Warner Music, then a whole load of people over at CAA, because for some reason in these lists, some of them are just an individual, and then others, they group together a load of people at one
company. It's like the Sunday Times Rich List, isn't it?
Well, I don't really understand why. Then Doug Morris, because he is still technically at Sony, although basically he's retiring. Corin over at Red Light Management, Jeff at Amazon. Oh, look, number 13, Michelle. So you do get a woman if you go down to number 13.
Not in the top 10, though.
But don't worry, she shares the position number 30. Don't be thinking they've given number 13 to a woman in music on her own. So she shares it with her colleague Boyd. And you have to go all the way down to Jody, who obviously runs Universal Music Publishing, who's at number 17. I would actually put her way higher up than that. And also she is quite influential, says a lot of stuff. And actually, of all the people from the major labels, often when she's talking, she's sort of like, yeah, you seem to know what you're talking about. So I would have her way higher up. So there you go, another music industry thing. And of course, whenever these lists come out, it's like, well, is that just that we have an industry where there is no gender diversity at the top, so it's inevitable when you do a power list that it always ends up being very male-dominated, certainly at the top of the list, or is it how they are choosing? The idea that you just basically look at the biggest companies in the music industry, write all their CEOs out, and that's your top 20.
Yeah, the power list is not a scientifically chosen thing, I don't think.
So should they be trying a little bit harder and looking for a more diverse range of people? But anyway, that's the Billboard power list. It just occurs to me, I wonder... who's in the CAA? Because I didn't really read the CAA list. There might be a woman in that. I might be being unfair. Rob, Daryl, Mitch, Rick. No, none of them sound like they're women. So we can stick with that.
Okay, well, you can read all of those stories in full if you go and find the show notes for this show at completemusicupdate.com/podcast. All the links will be in there. Have a little read. Finally, on this week's podcast, we get back to one of your questions. In fact, this started out as one of your questions, and after we talked about it a bit, it's grown into something quite a lot bigger.
Yes, it was a very simple question we were asked, but then immediately it sort of suggested a whole lot of other questions.
Yeah, so basically, Zach Smith asked, do PRS pay themselves to broadcast music in their building, or are they exempt?
So does PRS need a PRS licence to play music, so recorded music, whether that's on the radio or CD playing, in their headquarters in King's Cross? They've got other offices too, don't they? Streatham. Are they in Streatham?
Yeah.
And somewhere else as well. So does PRS need a PRS licence, Andy Malt?
Yes.
Yes, they do.
Yes, PRS, because we asked. Because we didn't know. We went and asked them and they said, yes, PRS's operating company, PRS for Music Limited, does pay for a PRS and PPL licence to play music by means of TVs and radios in its offices. PRS also pays a PRS and PPL licence for any music events it hosts externally where applicable.
So there
That's
you
interesting.
Go.
Interesting. And then that made us think, PPL as well.
Yes.
Does PPL... So have a PRS and PPL licence.
PRS being the collecting society that represents songwriters and publishers. PPL being the collecting society that represents record labels and recording artists. And obviously, if you are playing a recording of a song in a public space, then you're exploiting both of the rights, the recording right and the song rights. So you need a licence for both. As of the end of the year, If it's just a public performance of a recording, you'll be able to get one licence from the PPL-PRS joint venture, name to be confirmed. But as it currently stands, you can't do that. So, PPL licences also exist. So, does PPL need a PPL licence?
No.
No?
No.
Apparently.
Due to the basis on which PPL holds its members' rights, it is not necessary for PPL to grant a licence to itself.
But... PPL's members do not control the song rights, so...
PPL does have... PRS license.
Yeah, because obviously, although PPL's members control the recording rights, so the copyright and the sound recordings that are being played, they have nothing to do with the song copyright, so therefore they need a PRS license. So therefore, PRS has both.
Yeah.
PPL only needs a PRS license.
So it's good to know if you're a musician, there's more money to be made by having your music played in PRS's building than PPL's.
Yes. So I've said, a lot more people work at PRS than PPL, so probably there's a higher chance of your music being played.
But this question coming up made us think about a few like other exemptions to these licenses, because there are various things that come up and people ask about, and sometimes we're not entirely sure.
Yeah, sometimes we don't know the answer. Imagine that. And the first one of these, once we were discussing this because this question had come in, I remember when I was a teenager, mm-hmm. a very long time ago.
Very, very long time ago.
I worked in a newsagent's that also sold some music. Not a lot. It was just a little shelf. It had some CDs. I think it even sold some vinyl 7-inches, so like the top 20 and some new releases. But there were some CDs on a rack. And this shop didn't have music playing normally during the day. It wasn't a shop that had music playing over the sound system. But when we were working in the evening and all the grown-ups had gone home... We used to put CDs on because we wanted music while we were working. And all the people I used to work with, admittedly, none of them were management, I don't think. But there used to be this thing where we used to say, oh, providing we're selling the CD, we're allowed to play it. Well, obviously, we didn't really know what a PPL PRS license was. But there was this line that, oh, we're allowed to play music, providing we're selling it. The idea being that because it's promoting a product, therefore... The record company, the publisher, will be fine with you playing it because basically it's free promo. It's the classic free promo line. And I actually think that there are some people out there who still think that's probably the case.
Yeah.
It is not the case.
No, it is not.
It doesn't matter if you're selling the product.
Oh, this is actually, I think this might be something we've discussed on the podcast before about record shops having to have a PRS and PPL license to play the music that they're selling.
Yes.
In the store.
And I mean, that was in the news not so long ago, because when PPL PRS announced the joint venture that I just alluded to, the Entertainment Retailers Association, who represent record shops, said, oh, great that you're joining up to be more efficient. Will that mean that the licenses that our members, the record shops, have to pay for, will the prices come down because you're going to be joined up and more efficient? And it's a bit annoying we have to have licenses to start with because we're selling your products. So could we get a discount? And if I remember rightly, PRS and PPL sort of said, oh, we can't comment on that. That's not really what this is about. But so record shops do need to get licenses from both PPL and PRS.
Yes.
Even if they're playing tracks that are on sale in the shop.
Yes. And we asked PPL this. He said that there is a limited exemption that applies where a shop is selling equipment for receiving broadcasts, so TVs and radios, and plays broadcasts containing music in order to demonstrate that equipment.
Yeah. So had there been a radio in this newsagent I worked in that was for sale, and had someone come to the counter and said, oh, that's a nice-looking radio, how does it work? And I turned it on and said, oh, this is how it works. Here, this is Radio 1, this is Signal Radio, the local radio station. That would have been fine, but I couldn't have then left it on for us to listen to once the customer had left the shop. You can only have a little bit of music playing for the purposes of demonstration, is basically what they're saying. That was what PPL said. Don't know about PRS's
yes.
position.
So if
that.
You're selling TVs and radios, but you just have... a CD playing all day, you still need a license.
I think we can safely assume nobody listening to this podcast is selling TVs or radios, so it doesn't matter.
You don't know.
What the rule is there.
The other one that comes up quite frequently...
And actually, this comes up a lot.
The question we get asked...
That sort of sounds like I walk down the street and people keep asking. But it does come up surprisingly often, this question.
So we know that... Well, actually, I think this might come as a surprise for some people. However... Let's say we know. We know that if you're a company playing music in your office, you need PRS and PPL licenses.
And it doesn't matter what kind of office you are, doesn't matter what kind of business you are. Basically, if you are playing recorded music of songs in a place of work, that is a public performance of both the recording and the song. So you need a PPL and a PRS license. And PPL and PRS do a lot of work. And indeed, one of the reasons for this JV is rather than both those societies having to go and knock on the door of every single workplace in the country and saying, do you listen to music? Now they can do it once and then give them the combined license. But what's the little possible get out here?
Yeah, see, the actual question that comes up fairly frequently is, what if your staff are listening to music on headphones? Do you still need a license? The answer is probably not.
But both PRS and PPL, when we checked on this, were quite specific to state that technically for that exemption to apply, the employee needs to be listening to music not only on headphones, but via their own portable music device. So if it is a device provided by the workplace, so you couldn't have a stereo with lots of headphones plugged into it, and the stereo's owned by the thing. So it's only if people are basically listening to their own music collection on their own portable device, then that's not a public performance, and therefore a PPL and PRS licence is not required.
Yes, in fact, the specifics of this are quite interesting. So PRS noted, you know, if you're listening to music on your own portable device, an MP3 player or whatever, and only you can hear it, then that is fine. The company doesn't need a licence. However, if I was to play you some music off my portable device, then that changes everything.
Even if I was listening to it on your headphones, or my headphones, but plugged into your device,
it
gets complicated, doesn't it? So if you are listening to a track on your headphones and then you really like it and you want to say to me, oh, you should go and listen to this, you have to say, you should go and listen to this. So you need to get your phone out of your pocket and start up your Spotify and plug in your headphones and listen to it there.
Yes.
Otherwise, copyright infringement, see you in court.
Yeah, correct.
That's a good technicality. We like technicalities.
And then next, we started by asking, does PRS need a PRS license? What about if you're a music company and you own the rights in some music and you play that music in your offices?
Yeah, so you're the label and you only play records that you've put out, or you're a publisher and you only play recordings of songs that you publish. Do you still need a license? Now, obviously, the label is likely to need a PRS license because they will only own the recording rights, and a publisher is likely to need a PPL license because they will only own the publishing rights. But what about whichever side of the equation they own the rights?
Well, PRS said a music company which was playing works in which none of the rights were represented by PRS can, of course, do so without a PRS license.
But that's sort of irrelevant because any music you're going to be playing is almost certainly going to be written by at least one of the songwriters are going to either be a PRS member or they're going to be a member of an equivalent of PRS somewhere else in the world that has a reciprocal agreement with PRS.
Yes.
So let's assume that it is a song that has been written by PRS members or members of an equivalent organisation elsewhere in the world.
Well, in that case, you would need a PRS licence.
Even if you're the publisher. And I suppose this is an interesting point about publishing contracts, that here in the UK, this varies from country to country, but publishing contracts are different to record contracts. That when a songwriter signs a publishing deal, under a classic publishing deal, there is assignment in that deal. So the publisher becomes the copyright owner rather than the songwriter. That's what a classic publishing deal does. However, the performing rights are not part of that deal. And the songwriter assigns the performing rights to PRS. So even though the publisher publishes the song and they control all the other elements of the copyright, the performing rights actually go to PRS. And what the publisher gets through the publishing contract is 50% of the money. They get a share of the revenue, but they don't get control over the performing rights. So that's why, even though you're the publisher of the song, you don't control the performing rights. And if you play the song in your office, that's a public performance. So you still need to go and get a license from PRS. However, on the recording side, when a record deal occurs and there's assignment of copyright from the artist to the label, in that scenario, the label gets all of the copyright, all the elements, all the controls that come with the copyright. So that split between the performing rights and everything else doesn't happen in recordings. So therefore, if you're a label and you're playing your own releases, you'll need a PRS license for the songs, but on the recording side,
yeah, I think you'd be okay.
You don't need a PPL license, providing it is your own releases and you are covered on the publishing side. So if you are a very arrogant label that only ever plays their your own releases and you never play anything that's been released by anybody else, then you might get away with it. But go on, listen to somebody else's music for a change.
There's a lot of good music out there. Music you release is probably rubbish.
It probably is. The last point that PPL made, which I think is interesting, is because you sort of said, are there any other misconceptions? Like that thing I said earlier where I was told when I worked in a shop. And they said that one common misconception is, even if people know that they need a license to cover music and they have a TV in their office and there is music contained within the TV, there's confusion about the name TV license.
Yeah.
Just because you have a TV license doesn't mean that you're licensed for the music contained within the TV programmes.
One of the common misconceptions amongst businesses is that they assume that a TV license covers them for the public performance of music via that television. And that is not the case. If there's music coming out of that TV, then you still need a PRS and PPL license.
And some people sometimes think, with both TV and radio, because the TV station has licensed the music and because the radio station has licensed the music, therefore surely it's fine. But it's the technicality that, let's give radio, when a radio station broadcasts a recording, they're exploiting the communication element of the copyright, and that is what they are licensed to do. When you then turn the radio on in a public place, you're exploiting the public performance element of the copyright. Nobody's licensed that, so you need a license from PRS. So just because the radio station is licensed or the TV station is licensed doesn't make any difference. Radio stations hate that, because they would obviously like people to tune into the radio rather than playing a CD, and they call that double taxation. But it has come up in court, and it has been confirmed that they are two different elements of the copyright. So both the radio station and the person playing the radio needs a license.
Yeah, so hopefully that has brought some clarity to not only Zach Smith's original question, but many other questions surrounding PRS and PPL licences.
Although we should point out that any statements on the See Me podcast do not constitute legal advice.
Yeah. But these are all things that PRS and PPL told us, so let's assume that they're right. If you have a question for us that you'd like us to answer in that level of detail, email us at cmupodcast@unlimitedmedia.co.uk and we will get back to you on a future podcast. As Chris said at the beginning, next couple of weeks are going to be a bit different. We're going to have some highlights of sessions at Output Belfast.
If you're at Output Belfast, come and see those sessions live. We're doing one on music PR, basically all the silly mistakes that music PRs make. So if you are pitching your music to radio or to magazines and websites, come and find out how not to do it. And then on that, you'll understand how to do it. Does that make sense? We've also got a great session on digital and where digital market's going. So a bit of a generic overview, but then specifically on how you drive streams and how you build relationships with the streaming services. We've got Sammy Andrews and Brian Johnson from Spotify giving some insights as well as my presentation. So if you're at Output in Belfast, I'll see you there.
But for this week, that's it. So just remains for me to say goodbye. Goodbye. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
The principle of transparency is an important element of well-functioning...
Functioning.